Hello there, this is Dan Mangan, and right now, whether you know it or not, you are currently listening to 90.1 FM dial CJSF in Burnaby. Have yourself a marvelous day.
Hello, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Stay warm out there, folks. It is a wet one. We are also on the internet at cjsf.ca and TELUS HD channel 7014. It is Human Rights Day on Wednesday, December the 10th, so today we are focusing on human rights. My first guest is a lawyer with the Pivot Legal Society, Adrian Smith, and she'll be talking to us about Crosstown Clinic, which is the center of a new drug trial which uses small amounts of heroin to treat heroin addicts. So we'll be getting to talk about that, legalized heroin, legalized drug use. And in the second half of the show, you'll be hearing from freelance comedian Elvira Kurt, who comments on Gian Gomeshi and sexual assault in general. But first, we have a song from the lovely Shovels and Rope. This is Stono River Blues.
I'm on my boat on the old Stono. That river take you anywhere that you want to go. Sail on the Ashley or the Eddystone, but don't get caught in the mud when the tide is low.
So, on the phone with me now is Adrian Smith from the Pivot Legal Society in Vancouver. Adrian, hello, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for your interest.
So, you're with the Pivot Legal Society, and I know you guys have been working with the Crosstown Clinic, which, if I'm correct, gives heroin addicts small doses of legalized heroin in an effort to help with their addiction. Do I have sort of the general basis of that correct?
That's right. Let's start with the study that these patients were enrolled in. There was 202 patients at the Crosstown Clinic, which is a healthcare facility in the downtown east side, and they were participating in a study that was testing the effectiveness of two drugs for the treatment of long-term heroin dependency. One of those drugs is a drug called hydromorphone, which is a painkiller called Dilaudid when you get it prescribed to you. And the other one is diacetylmorphine, which is the active ingredient in heroin. And what we found with these patients was that in the time in their study, their health outcomes improved substantially. They put on enough weight to be healthy. Some of them got stable enough to be able to address some of their other long-term health problems, like hepatitis C. They developed lasting relationships in the community. One of them reconnected with his long-lost daughter. A couple of them took up volunteer work. These are all really good outcomes for these patients. So when their time in the study ended, their doctors applied to keep them on the medication that had stabilized them. Health Canada agreed, but the Minister of Health intervened to change the regulations to keep this medication away from those patients, and that's when we went to court.
And I know that the BC Supreme Court just came down and said you guys can continue doing this, but I understand that it's going to be decided in the Supreme Court of Canada sometime in 2016?
Not quite. So we brought a BC Supreme Court action saying that the Section 7 charter rights of this group of patients was being infringed by the minister's decision to change the regulations. That case is going to BC Supreme Court in 2016 in the spring. But at the same time, we applied for an injunction that would keep these patients on their medication until we went to trial. So that's why treatment started in the neighborhood last week. And it's really, really important to keep these people well and in care while we wait for this process to wind its way through the courts. Whether it will make it to the Supreme Court of Canada really depends on the outcome, but the first step is certainly to go to the BC Supreme Court.
Well, it definitely is important to note that this trial has worked. I think it's also important to understand why it worked. Have you guys been able to ascertain what it is specifically about the drug or the trial that allowed these patients to get healthy again?
Well, we knew that heroin as a treatment for long-term heroin dependency worked, and we knew that from over 200 European studies, and we knew it from a Vancouver study that ran from 2005 to 2008 called NAOMI. So the effectiveness of heroin as a treatment is established. What this current study that's just wrapping up now called Salome was building on that research and was testing heroin against hydromorphone to see if hydromorphone was as effective as heroin. So heroin is an effective treatment, and again, I'm not a doctor, but as I understand it, heroin is a proven effective treatment for long-term heroin dependency. And I mean, the science behind it is very, very clear. It's the Minister of Health who's dismissing it as a viable treatment.
I believe Rona Ambrose, the health minister, said something along the lines of treating addicts with drugs is not something that we want to promote. What needs to happen at the government level to change the conversation, to start treating this as a mental health issue rather than a criminal issue?
Well, I think the Minister of Health is making decisions about access to medication based on ideology, in line with the federal government's tough-on-crime war on drugs. We know that that tactic doesn't work. And what would it take to change the minister's mind? I'm not sure that I know that. It could be something as simple as the government actually listening to scientists, which is something that it's demonstrated distaste for as well.
And you know, you mentioned you're not a doctor, and of course, you know, neither are a lot of people in Parliament. Is that part of the problem that we're not electing people who are knowledgeable about the things that they're trying to pass laws about?
Well, I think we need our parliamentarians to be good parliamentarians. We don't need them all to be experts in addiction medicine, because those people exist out in the world and they're doing the good work and they're available all the time to speak to government when government needs it. It's that the Minister of Health and the Harper government aren't listening to scientists and they're not listening to researchers. We saw this from the very beginning of the Harper regime, and it's something that's going on today.
So what I've read is that there's a specific amount of heroin that has been used to treat the addicts. How In terms of a policy scheme, how is that amount regulated per patient? How does that whole system come into play? The regulatory.
Well, there's really two questions. There's a upper limit, a total limit of heroin that Canada is allowed to import per year, and this is an estimate based on the amount that's going to be needed for studies and other purposes. What's suitable for each individual patient is really a question between them and their doctor. And those who had participated in the Salome study and are still connected to the clinic, that dosage is really clear. For people who left the study when their time ended and have been waiting for all of this time to get back on this medication, those doctors need to start with them again and find out what dosage is appropriate. But I think what I have to say about dosage is that that's not really a question that we generally expect the ministers of the crown to have a say in. If you have a medical condition, you require a certain amount of medication. That's between you and your physician, and it shouldn't be a question that the minister can grandstand about.
I'm reading here that, and you can correct me if this is wrong, but that the diacetylmorphine is actually made in Switzerland.
That's right.
Why go to Europe to outsource our heroin, if you will?
Well, there's no Canadian manufacturing ability for pharmaceutical-grade diacetylmorphine. It's manufactured in Switzerland, and it's brought into Canada legally by a legal Canadian importer. This is the supply process that the clinic elected when it started the study, and it's sticking with that for the treatment phase now. And that is a reliable and secure source of diacetylmorphine and medication for these patients.
There seems to be a lot of, in terms of drug policy, Europe seems to be a good place to turn for at least what we want to model our system after, if you will. How would you compare our current drug policy here in Vancouver and even in Canada to some of the more liberal policies out there in places like Germany, Switzerland, Netherlands? How are we doing?
I think a lot of cutting-edge addiction medicine is happening in Vancouver, and it's a place where we can expect some great developments in terms of research. In terms of treatment, that's definitely a place where the federal government's interference isn't doing any good to the patients in question. Prescription heroin has been commonplace in specialized addiction medicine centers across Europe. In England, in fact, you can even get a take-home portion of your medication, and you're not required to consume it in the clinic after you've been compliant, and there's a very low risk. It's treated like a medicine, and we shouldn't forget that heroin was invented by the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company and was a medicine cabinet standard for many of our grandparents' generation. So the stigma that attached to it just because it's heroin, and chemically it's very similar to morphine, and I think the federal government's political position is getting in the way of what, as I understand it, is very good medicine.
And I know in Europe and in places like Amsterdam, Netherlands, they make a distinguish between the hard drugs like cocaine and heroin and soft drugs like marijuana, for example. I find it kind of curious that we sort of, in effect, legalized heroin before we've legalized marijuana to a certain degree. Do we need to treat all drugs as the same going forward, or do we still need to make that distinction?
What I will say is that marijuana is available as a medicine because some courageous patients went to court and argued that they needed it, and the medicine behind that was sound. The court found that there needed to be legal access to marijuana, and so there is. What's happening now with heroin is constitutionally very, very similar. You have a charter right to medication that keeps you well. I would agree with you that the government's position to criminalize drugs is problematic and expensive, and it doesn't work. And when these substances can be used as medication and they have good outcomes for patients with low adverse reactions, then I certainly trust addiction doctors to prescribe what's appropriate.
One of the phrases that always comes up in these conversations is public health. You know, that a lot of addicts, there's a myth, I think, that a lot of addicts can be dangerous to the general public. What do you have to say about that? Is there any risk at all to the general public with a trial like this?
What's dangerous about illicit drugs is that it is criminalized, and therefore most of its manufacture, sale, and use happens in the black market. One of the unintended consequences of the Salome study that we know anecdotally, the study's not published yet, we also saw this with Naomi, both Naomi and Salome report this, that when people have a reliable and safe source for the medication that keeps them from going into withdrawal, their criminal activity reduces. It goes down. There's a very good documentary that I would recommend to your listeners called Anyone for Coffee and Heroin. You can Google this, and it talks about a Danish center where people are treated with prescription heroin, and you can see the interview when they talk to the patient and they say, and how many days this month have you engaged in criminal activity? And the person at the end says zero, and they say, well, in the beginning it would have been every day. And that's something that we're certainly seeing in Vancouver. That's things that my clients tell me, is that when they have a reliable source of the medication that they need, their lives stabilize, their criminality reduces, their contact with police and jail services goes down. Those are very good outcomes for public health. And I think it really conflates two problems to say that treatment with heroin will lead to an increase in crime. The fact that heroin is illegal is why there's crime swirling around it. Treating people with heroin as a medication to stabilize their lives actually has a positive impact on crime by reducing crime and making our communities safer.
Now, I know this study has been focused in the downtown east side, and I know that area is also very high in HIV. In fact, I think I read it has one of the highest rates outside of Africa. And I'm curious, this is kind of a two-part question, whether you see any comorbidity between addiction and HIV, and whether you can foresee something like what's happening at Crosstown using some sort of drug like heroin to treat HIV infection.
Well, prescription heroin is a treatment for heroin dependency. HIV is treated with a different suite of medications, a series of antiretroviral medications. The correlation between drug use and bloodborne pathogen infectious disease, like HIV and hepatitis C, is that, again, the use of injectable drugs is illegal, so people inject in dangerous places if there's no safe place for them to be. And with limited access to safe equipment to inject, so if there's no access to clean syringes, then people reuse the ones that they have. And when there's access to clean syringes and clean, well-lit, safe places for people to inject in, then we see a reduction in the spread of communicable diseases like HIV and hepatitis C.
So now that this study has in effect been, you guys were granted the injunction to keep going. What do you see moving forward with this study? Where is Pivot taking it? Where is Crosstown taking it? What does the future hold?
Well, researchers at Crosstown are preparing to publish the results of their study, and that will be coming out sometime in the coming months or years. Pivot is focused on the litigation, and we're looking forward to moving the case forward and making submissions to the court which show that the constitutional rights of drug users and their right to life, liberty, and security of the person are infringed and violated by the Minister of Health's move to restrict access to this medication. And the legal basis for this is the Insight case. It was called Canada and PHS, and it's the case that prevented the minister from closing down the Insight facility. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Canada was very, very clear to show that injection drug users have a constitutional right to health care that will keep them alive. And this is a very similar situation with some of the very same people.
Speaking of insight, I was just reading about Bill C-2, and I believe Mr. Wilkes, who was the MP debating it, says that insight hasn't actually prevented overdoses. What has insight done in the since it's been open and operated to curb or at least help stop the hardcore drug use?
Yeah, I was alarmed to read Mr. Wilkes' comments in Hansard when he spoke in the House of Commons about this. It's a shocking mischaracterization of what's actually happened at Insight. And what we see is a reduce in criminality. We see a reduction in the spread of HIV. We see an increase in the uptake of detoxification services. And we see a virtual elimination of overdose deaths. People used to die all the time in Vancouver when they overdosed from opiates. Now they don't. Over the Thanksgiving weekend, there were 36 overdoses. The ones that happened at Insight, everybody lived. The ones that happened outside of Insight, 4 people died. And I think we can agree, regardless of where we stand on drug policy, that having our neighbors still be alive is a really good thing.
And finally, I know not only do you work a lot in the downtown east side, but I know that you also live in that area. For you, why is it important to be to live in amongst those that you work with?
Well, I didn't get this job and then move to the neighborhood. I lived in the neighborhood for a long time, and then I got this job. And like all the other people who live and work in the downtown east side with marginalized communities, it's not a thing you do for fun for a line on your resume. We do it because this is a vibrant and stable community, and I respect my neighbors, and I want them to be alive. These people who die, these people who overdose from drugs in Vancouver or any other community across the country, these are people's neighbors. They're people's daughters and sons. They're mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, and they're entitled to health care that will keep them alive and make them as well as they can be.
Well, Adrian Smith, Pivot Legal Society, thank you so much for your chat today. Best of luck in Crosstown with the litigation. Best of luck in moving the conversation about mental health issues and drug policy forward. And thank you for your time today.
Thanks for your interest. Have a great night.
Right, cheers. Bye-bye. That was Adrian Smith, who is Pivot Legal Society's health and drug policy advocate. They graduated from the UBC Law School, where they specialized in social justice law, and earlier this year were called to the bar. You can visit pivotlegal.org for more information, and you can also Google Crosstown Clinic. And once again, the documentary that Adrian mentioned was Anybody for Coffee and Heroin. Okay, we have a couple of announcements for you, and then another song, and then we're going to get to our chat with the lovely Elvira Kurt. So just hang tight.
Of Human Rights.
CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. On the internet at cgsf.ca, where we stream and podcast all your favorite CGSF shows. And tell us HD channel 7014. Today we are talking about human rights in honor of International Human Rights Day on Wednesday, December the 10th. And here at CGSF, we will have about 5 or 6 hours of International Human Rights Day coverage all day at the station, including probably a re-airing of the interviews you hear today. So stay tuned for that. That is coming up on Wednesday, December the 10th. And coming up right now is a song. This is from Canada's own Mecca Normal, Gene Smith, and David Lester. This is Wasn't Said.
When
And that was Mecha Normal with Wasn't Said. That is off their new album, Empathy for Evil. And Mecha Normal is, of course, Gene Smith and David Lester. And that track also featured Kramer on the organ and the bass. Check them out, Mecha Normal. You may remember David being a guest on the show a few years ago about his graphic novel. Speaking of a graphic, my next guest is freelance comedian and the host of the Culture Hall of Shame every Friday on CBC's show Q. She has been one of the go-to people to talk to about the Gian Gomeshi scandal and recently came out and said, consent needs to be the new C word. I had a chance to talk with her about Gian consent and everything else in the sexual assault conversation. This is Elvira Kurt, and this is what we had talked about not so long ago. Is comedian and host of Q's Culture of Shame on Fridays, Elvira Kurt. Hello, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
How are you doing today? How's life out there in the East or Central Canada?
Great. Well, is it Central? Yes, I don't know where we are. Everything's great.
So let's jump right in.
Sure, let's do it.
We all know what happened a couple months ago with Gian. And I'm curious, you know, you obviously worked with the man. What was your, can you describe what your reaction was? What you felt when you first found out about Gian and why he was fired?
My God, it's like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, but the sordid version.
Yeah.
Do you remember where you were?
When?
You know, I feel like it was the same experience that, you know, every fan of the show felt. I was alerted by text from a friend who's like, hey, what's up with Gian? I heard he got fired. And so I went right to the CBC website, and I was shocked, same as everyone. You know, and since I'd never heard any rumors of predatory behavior on his part, I went to my own personal worst-case scenario, which is like, oh, my God, it's kiddie porn. Right? I mean, what else could... You know, especially a firing kind of worded that way, you know, right away you went to the reading between the lines. And like I said, because I hadn't heard any of that stuff that we've since come to learn, that, you know, for me it would be either something you don't want anyone to know about your kiddie porn, or, you know, yeah. So it was the same. And then, of course, a few hours later, you know, when he posted his Dear Everyone letter on Facebook, you know, it feels like we all fell through the rabbit hole, and suddenly things made sense and no sense at all at the same time. Oh, he's into rough sex, right? That was which, you know, everyone's like, who cares? And then but wait, you know, and he makes reference to 50 Shades of Grey. Anyone who's, you know, even tangentially related to that world knows that 50 Shades of Grey has nothing to do with that sort of, you know, predilection sexually. So that's what I mean. Like, things make sense, but then they don't make sense at all. You know, I remember reading that post, and on the first read through, you're very sympathetic to Gian. And then, you know, if you read it again, because you have to, because it's like, I'm trying to wrap your head around it, then, you know, all kinds of things stuck out for me, right? Like, he was name dropping Canlit, and like, oh, that's so Gian, you know, the big eye roll. And then, you know, jilted exes, the mention of that seemed sort of weird and out of place. And, you know, he feeling persecuted, that also seemed, you know, fit his personality. You know, but then all of that to me was sort of subsumed by my concern for the leather community, that bigger implication for the leather community, which would be like, oh, now they're going to have to face backlash for their lifestyle, which is going to be seen as deviant and perverted. That's honestly, you know, how the sort of the chronology of my reaction sequence.
The artist from the man, can we separate Gian's on-air personality from his private life? Can we separate Q from the man who used to run the show? You know, evidently it appears that this has been going on for a number of years, and there's been a lot of talk about the CBC, what they should have done differently, what they could have done, what they need to do. Do you think initially that there was anything that they could have or should have done differently when first hiring Gian?
Geez, I mean, you know, this question is really like the, you know, there but for the grace of God, go I situation, you know, that can be asked of any employee or employer of any massive corporation ever. I mean, there's just so much at play here. Could they have done anything differently? I mean, I know for, you know, going from the other end of it, like working from the ground up, like the staff who worked on the show, the team at Q, I know that, you know, they had been, it was a stressful work situation for them, right?
Yeah.
I knew, but, you know, because of, again, of this whole, you know, separating the artist and the man and the conflating the two, it just becomes something that you get used to. Well, we work with someone who is very high strung or a very high maintenance personality, and you just, over time, you get used to that those are your working conditions. It's not ideal, and so I know that it was stressful, and, you know, since the story broke, you get the sense that they had complained. So from their end of it, I'm sure it would have been great if they had, I don't think they felt listened to, and it would have been great if they felt like they could take their grievances somewhere to someone who would have acted upon them. You know, I've never been someone who's aspired to management, so I can't really speak to what someone would have done from the top down. You would think that, you know, if you respect people who work for you, you would take the things that they say seriously, and you would want to make sure that everyone has a working condition that is not described as toxic, you know, somewhere that you want to go to work. So it's, you know, I can't understand, you know, why something like that wouldn't be respected or enforced. But, you know, like I said, I've never aspired to that kind of position. Yeah. So I don't know how they can. What kind of mentality do you have to, if you heard any of those complaints, to not pay attention to them? And if you are oblivious to them, then that also says something. How are you so far removed that you have no sense of the fact that, you know, the people who are working for you are under a certain kind of duress? I think my reaction is, I hear myself talking, I feel like I sound like everyone in Canada, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm a freelance. I don't think anyone really has job, feels like they have job security at the CBC, because, you know, cuts can come at any time and out you go. And as a freelancer, it's even more tenuous. You know, I would leave the show every week and I'm like, I hope I'm invited back. You know, there's no guarantee, because you don't know what it's based on. I mean, I don't feel any more secure at Q since this happened than I did before, working for someone who, you know, we would easily describe as, you know, a high-strung, narcissistic, neurotic, whatever you want to say about anyone who's, you know, in that kind of a position. Like, I don't feel any more secure now that, you know, he's been taken out of the picture, and that has nothing to do with Gian, and it has everything to do with being a freelancer.
Yeah.
You know, and also in the Canadian entertainment business, when there's no guarantee that you're ever going to work again.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps us hungry.
I mean, Gian is not the only case we've heard about this year. Of course, there's the NFL, Gamergate, Bill Cosby now.
Right.
But do you think, is it a sign of the times that so many more victims are coming forward and willing to speak out?
Yeah, it's a sign of the times. I guess it's, you know, it's definitely on the radar. I think, you know, the more cases you hear, I think there's just an awareness by people who value self-awareness and self-consciousness, right? Like, to be, you know, you don't want to be a passive, you want to be more engaged, right?
Yeah.
So you don't want to just, like, passively receive your entertainment. You're, you know, you're being more critical, right? Like, I love football, but, you know, then you hear the story because you see the videotape. I think, you know, the our ability to connect with situations more intimately because of social media makes you feel, you know, that level of engagement. I think the stakes might be higher, and then suddenly, you know, it's not just an isolated story, but it's just, it's like a flood of stories. And I think that people then to become, you know, you become aware of how deep the problem is, right? You can't ignore it anymore. You can't just write it off as, well, it's that one guy. Suddenly it's like, which guy isn't doing that, right, in the NFL? Or, you know, you know what I mean? Like, you're just becoming, you can't ignore it. And, you know, we see it with violence against women. You see it with racism, obviously, right, with these the protests that are going on now in Ferguson and New York City over the officer who wasn't indicted for the chokehold that killed Eric Garner. And, you know, these are the, when we're talking about things like violence against women and racism, you know, we're speaking about a certain kind of privilege that both of these groups don't have, and that is being exercised. And, you know, it's a kind of an awareness that, you know, this gap between, you know, people that have privilege and then, you know, the survivors of these kinds of, like, the mistreatment is just, it's glaring. Like, how do we bridge that gap? So I think that, you know, the fact that it's constantly in the forefront now. Like, you can't, every day, I'm just, you know, as soon as I, you know, their website loads, you're like, what awaits me today, right? What new case of something is going to be sitting there?
I mean, at the same time, you know, Cosby, Gian, people like Stephen Collins, Ray Rice, they're all celebrities. That they are celebrities, and that our obsession with celebrity culture is feeding all this information that we now have about certain celebrities like Bill and Gian and Ray Rice.
Our fascination with celebrity culture, well, I think it's double-edged, I think, is the way I would describe it. I mean, it puts attention on them, but initially, I think it protects them, right? Like, the reason that Cosby got away with it for so long, and I mean, you know, it was 10 years in between, you know, the last time it made the news and now it feels like it's unstoppable. And the thing that's changed is social media. So that's what I go back to, is like our ability to become more intimately involved in it. And then just to, you know, the fact that social media is the immediacy of it keeps it front and center. You know, that's one aspect of it. But, you know, initially, the fascination, you know, the fact that we hold celebrities up in such high regard protects them, because it would, as we've learned, it keeps the accusers silent, because the retribution is so swift and painful for anyone who dares to say something against, you know, Mr. Pudding Pops or whatever, the guy who was the reverend on, you know, this TV show, right? Like, I think it protects them, and I think it silences the abusers. And then once the stories break, you know, my concern is that, you know, we still talk about, you know, about Gian, or we still talk about Bill Cosby, when, you know, what the focus needs to be on is the women, right? Like, we're talking about people who've had to live with, you know, lives that can never be the same. And what are we going to do to make sure that doesn't happen to women who are who meet violence at the hands of people who aren't celebrities, right? So it's double edged in that it our fascination, you know, gives the story more attention, but initially it serves to protect the person being accused, and then it keeps the focus in the wrong direction. As far as I'm concerned, I find it maddening. I'm still grappling with it myself. You know, I feel so. You know, my experience of really, like, being aroused, not aroused, but roused from complacency, being sort of rocketed into action because my own personal response to what happened with Jian was like, you know, I may not have known anything about his predatory nature, but, you know, these women felt like they couldn't come forward, and I'm complicit in that, in the sense that I've never spoken out when women have been, you know, made silent in any cases up until this point. And I, you know, it was like this personal realization that, you know, if nothing's going to change, if everyone just, you know, goes, oh my God, that's so horrible, and that's so unfortunate. Yeah. And I feel like now I need to always stand up and say that I see this, I see it, I'm a witness to it, and I'm not going to let it alone until we can make some kind of meaningful change. Everyone feels it. I feel like that's what the climate is, the culture. Like, you know, right now in Canada with the spotlight on Jian, it feels like people, you know, don't want this to continue. They don't want women to feel ashamed and to have to suffer in silence. And, you know, the fact that it has been going on since the story broke means that, you know, we still are in the stage of, like, good intentions, right?
Yeah.
You know, that Ranelle Harper was assaulted after the story broke. Two men, 16-year-old girl, Manitoba. There's, like, well, how could that happen? We're so outraged by, you know, what's going on in the country, then how could this happen? Here in Toronto, just over the weekend, a Somali woman and her two children were murdered by an abusive ex-husband. Allegedly, he committed suicide. So, you know, they're still, you know, trying to make the connection between those two cases. But I think, you know, everyone else has already connected those dots. And so why have these things happened if, you know, we feel like we want to collectively put our feet down and say, this is never going to happen anymore? Well, it's not that simple. But it starts with refusing to be silent, because the silence just, it sort of condones and is complicit in the, you know, everything that happened up until the Jian story. Just it maintains the status quo, and that's not working anymore, not for me.
Is it important to recognize, though, in this conversation about sexual assault, that men can be assaulted as well? Assault is gender blind. I believe there was a case of a man coming forward and saying, oh, Jian assaulted me when we were at university together.
Yeah, that's right. It was Jim Hounslow. And then since then, I mean, just last week even, Shia LaBeouf, you know, he did some art performance art piece in a art gallery, and he came forward to say that he'd been sexually assaulted, or something had happened against his will, but it's something that he did not consent to. And yeah, it can happen. I think, you know, people are when, you know, when you're against sexual violence, I think that that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
I'm against sexual violence. It doesn't really matter. Gender is, it happens to be greater cases of women than men, but it's reprehensible to whomever it happens. Yeah. Because it's erroneous to think that, oh, you know, how can it happen to a man? When you're talking about something happening against your will, a lack of consent, then that's what has been violated. That's what's been taken from you. I think it's pretty clear that it doesn't matter who it happens to.
And on the show a couple weeks ago, you, and sort of ties into the whole conversation, you mentioned consent needs to be the new C word. So what do you want the conversation to be going forward, especially in regards to how we educate the youth of tomorrow?
Oh boy. I think if you hear me struggling, it's because, you know, it feels like you just turn this problem over and over again. Like, if it could be that simple as, well, this was horrible, and it's never going to happen again, right? That's the simplistic answer. And yet it does happen. I mean, we're coming upon the 25th anniversary of the women who were murdered in at the Polytechnique. Why? Because they were women, right? I mean, it's, you would like to think that in 25 years we wouldn't be dealing with this, right? But I think that, you know, the key is to remove the stigma of silence. I think that, you know, the stories have to be heard and told, and what makes it difficult is that there's always suspicion, right? It's always, well, what if they're not telling the truth, or someone will cite an exception. Well, I know of a time when it wasn't true, or you can't say that women are always the victims of sexual violence. I grew up in a household where our mother was the terrorizer. These exceptions don't undermine any survivor who's come forward telling their story. It has that effect of casting it out, but it feels like a false equivalence. I always say, well, that's terrible about that fact that your mother was the terrorizer and your father was meek. That's terrible. We'll talk about that in a minute when we finish talking about the thing that we're talking about right now, which is violence against women or these women who've come forward. So I think that it needs to be, we need to honor the story of survivors. We need to make sure that they feel like they can be heard. So again, for me, the silence. I think we need to reject silence. That's got to go. Absolutely, consent. These little catchphrases like the C word, or no means no, or yes means yes. I mean, it really comes down to women need to. The way I'm trying to raise my daughter. So when you're talking about the youth of today and how they're, can they grow up differently? I think girls are always taught to be accommodating and nurturing, and all these girlish qualities. And while I think it's good to grow up and be a kind person, I think that we're doing girls a disservice by reinforcing this, the accommodating, nurturing elements, and negating or putting less focus on the fact that they're they can't be powerful. So I think that women have to, because I don't think men ever worry about their power. Everything in society sort of reaffirms all the ways that they can be powerful. I see it with my son. I see the way that he never plays a game. He wants to crush you when he plays a game. He's five, but that's the way he talks. And my daughter may have that same interest is in winning, but she expresses in a way that is more societally acceptable. And in these ways we chip away intrinsically at someone realizing their power. We push it down in the girls, and we play it up for the boys. And I think that everyone can raise to be a decent person, and girls can understand that the power that they have is theirs to have and cannot be taken from them or taken unwillingly, that it's something that they have to give. And that's what's so important about consent as the C word, is that it's not yours to take, it's mine to give. And I think that's something, as we, the message that we give to our daughters has to change. And by the same token, we also have to raise our boys differently. I want my son to be the one at that party in high school where if there is a girl who is wasted beyond the ability to consent to anything, to be the one to say to the other boys, no, we're not taking advantage of this girl. This girl, we need to get her home safely. Like, that is the sign of strength. Right now, what seems to be valued is this ability to take anything you want and just, you sort of assert your entitlement or your privilege when the opposite is true. In my eyes, what makes a man strong is his ability to understand how important it is to stand up and do the right thing, even when he's the only one who's doing it, and to withstand the way he will be demeaned for understanding. Yeah. The value of speaking up, right? Because men who speak up are ridiculed, right? You're a feminist? Well, then you must be a pussy. When the exact opposite should be valued. And I think that message is not being, we are doing boys a disservice if that's not what we're teaching them.
Well, I appreciate your candidness in talking about this issue today. Elvira Kurt, thank you so much for your time today.
I hope I sound like I rambled quite a bit. I hope I gave you something to cut in and out of there.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back to CGSF 90.1 FM Endeavors. You just heard my interview there with Elvira Kurtz. You can catch her Fridays on The Culture of Shame on CBC's Q. That about does it for the show today. My thanks to Elvira Kurtz. My thanks to Adrian Smith of the Pivot Legal Society. Stay tuned for the Jambalaya with Bo and also the Swan Song at 7 with David Swanson. We're going to take you out with Shovels and Rope Save the World, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
When you're caught in the wave of a terrible tide, suddenly you're struggling to stay astride. So you calm your hand and you cool your mind, and then you wake up happy on the other side. Honey, you got what it takes. You got what it takes to save the world. When there is trouble you cannot command, maybe it's God trying to guide your hand. Shine a little light upon the way you stand, so that you can genuinely understand. Honey, you got what it takes. You got what it takes to save the world. With sugar and cream.